Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host of Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. Today, we have the honor of welcoming back a guest many of you heard or know, Mr. Joel Kay, writer, author of The Crime of Impunity, The Crime of Punishment, a written comparison of the moral standing of the elite versus that of the street criminal to the great disadvantage of the elite. Joel Kay has been admired by many for his extensive knowledge and expertise in the areas of injustices in and out of the penal system. Although his master's was in social history, Joel wrote and worked on many political and criminal justice issues along with his wife, the late Sarah E. Wright, also a great novelist and author of the book, The Child's Gonna Live. Joseph Kay's primary focus has been the need for those who are incarcerated and their family and friends to think in political terms, to understand the place of the criminal justice system in our society, and based on that understanding, to organize both behind and outside the bars. Joe approached the subject when it became clear that the black man was being demonized, portrayed as a criminal, and this to put an end to the civil rights agitation. Joe, as many of us firmly believe, that white workers, poor whites, and whites of modest means has a stake in racial justice for a number of reasons, as Joe will discuss further as he speaks out on the need for a united political struggle against a brutal and racist criminal justice system. So let's welcome our guest once again, Joseph Kay. Joseph, are you with us? Joe, can you hear us? We're having a little difficulty. I think he is. Hold on a second, and let me see if I can get him on again. Hello, Joe?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, and I can hear us in the background.
Yeah, that'll. Yeah. That's you doing the introduction again.
We talk about all the injustice in this country, the United States of America.
And when this will be over in a second, I guess.
The experiences that you're going through with these injustices.
I don't know why this.
Anytime to provide feedback. Well, to talk about your.
They'll be over in a second, and I can.
Event or whatever else you may want to do.
Oh, well, I can turn that off. Hello, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. So I want to thank you for inviting me to your program.
It's an honor to have you on, Joe. You have an interesting story to tell, and I know the audience is going to be very interested in hearing it.
Well, I just have a few preliminary remarks, and then you could perhaps ask some questions or have the audience ask some questions. So my heart, of course, goes out to the family members of the incarcerated and to the incarcerated themselves. Not only is the fact of incarceration tragic, but also the conditions of imprisonment, conditions which, frankly, I would call barbaric. The philosophy of the criminal justice system is that wrenching people from their loved ones, their friends, their accustomed surroundings, their work, is not punishment enough, but that the convicted must be made as miserable as possible, as humiliated as possible, treated as subhuman, so that they come to feel subhuman. On top of that, of course, you get lousy food, little or no medical care, very difficult visitation conditions, and even phone communications sometimes are beyond the economic reach of families. Further, we need to ponder why this country, with about 5% of the world's population, accounts for about a quarter of the world's incarcerated. It is only natural that family members are mostly preoccupied with the well-being of their own loved ones who are behind bars, but while it is natural, actually for the most part, it leads nowhere. Once in a great while, through the family's efforts, some small victory may be won, some improvement in the conditions of their loved ones obtained, some small injustice rectified, but for the most part, their efforts lead nowhere. For individuals cannot prevail over the power of the state. And it's not a matter of some oversight, some negligence on the part of this or that prison official, but it's a pattern of deliberate abuse as a matter of policy. And if it is a matter of policy, then we're talking about politics. And herein lies the great weakness of family advocacy. It has generally been non-political. One must ask why the country which calls itself the leading democracy in the world has such a huge prison population and has about 80 million people burdened with criminal records. And one must ask why those behind bars are so disproportionately black and brown. And that's a tough one for white families to deal with because many accept the notion that black and brown people have a criminal disposition and fail to see how thoroughly racist the criminal justice system is and how prison represents the gated communities of the poor, especially of peoples of color, but of poor whites as well. It's indeed a matter of mere criminality within black and brown communities. Is that really the issue? The fact is, and you can find this in my book, The Crime of Impunity, The Crime of Punishment, that it is the fat cats, the rich white men and their corporations that commit infinitely more crimes, more serious crimes, more damaging to society than the perpetrators of ordinary street crime. Their swindles, their shady deals, their corruption of officials, tax evasion, their cheating of labor of what is the working people's due, their wars and military interventions resulting in the deaths of millions, their sanctions also resulting in the deaths of millions. These crimes are infinitely greater in their consequences than all the muggings and robberies and illegal drug pushing, etc., put together. And yet, they spend not a single day behind bars. Why? The answer is, of course, that they control the legal system. They make the rules, and they, through their stooges, cops, and DAs, enforce the rules or choose not to enforce them. If one is going to make a difference in fighting the criminal justice system, in helping one's loved ones in prison, there is need of a movement based on an understanding of the real purposes of the criminal justice system, and that is social control. A social control by the fat cats to protect their lives and property, to protect the system where a mere handful own and control the vast majority of the nation's wealth. The barbarism of the penal system is an essential part of that control. We need a movement that is clear-eyed on this, a movement that will not only advocate for all those languishing behind the wall, but for all other victims of social injustice. Once again, following the fading away of the Black Lives Movement, we see a renewed hysteria concerning crime, meaning black crime. Right-wing media are shrieking about a crisis in the cities of murder and mayhems caused by the soft-on-crime liberals, opening the prison gates to free dangerous criminals, reducing or eliminating bail requirements, all of which resulting in a reign of terror, of cities being turned over to the hoodlums, which a so-called handcuffed police, now underfunded and plagued with all kinds of bureaucratic obstacles to the proper and effective carrying out of their duties, are unable to contain. Now, even the liberals are claiming that things have, quote, gone too far, end quote, and that the police must be given the proper resources and that the measures taken under the pressure of the Black Lives Movement be reversed. What is different this time, however, is the epidemic of mass shootings. The epidemic of mass shootings, including that of children, has shocked the nation, Republican as well as Democrat. All agree something must be done. For the Democrats, the problem is reducible to the proliferation of guns, especially guns of mass destruction, while to the Republicans, holding on to their beloved guns is paramount. So the problem is the need for more mental health services. The fact is, we live in a violent culture, a culture where perpetrators of violence are glorified in our TV and movie fare, and where violence is proclaimed by our governmental authorities as a legitimate option in carrying out their foreign policy. Mass killings, whether at home or abroad, is, of course, facilitated by the easy availability of weapons. In this country, there are more weapons than people. And the bloated Pentagon budget, ensuring that the weapons and munitions makers get a healthy profit. The psychological aspect has to do with the profound alienation and lack of personal attention that is part and parcel of this dog-eat-dog society where ruthless competition is the key to success and mutual aid and cooperation are scarce and to be avoided if one wants to get ahead. There's a lot of talk within liberal circles of giving people who have, quote, transgressed, unquote, and duly punished a second chance. The conservatives, on the other hand, believe they should be damned to everlasting hellfire. But even we say to the liberals, if most people had had a first chance, they wouldn't need a second one. And all of this I discuss at length in my book, The Crime of Impunity, The Crime of Punishment, which can be ordered through Amazon.
I'll tell you, Joe, I really admire you for what you've done. Joe Kay has been working in this area for over 60 years. He and his wife were strong advocates for injustices, against injustices in this country. And I really hope and pray that you will look for that book and you will see what it's all about, because it is very interesting. And Joe, what you were talking about, I'm telling you, it's so true, because so many people of color behind those prison walls are paying a high price for the crimes that they've committed. And people stereotype. They stereotype these individuals as though they're all hardcore criminals. They fail to realize there are a lot of wrongfully convicted behind those walls. A lot of them are victims of crime in the court system, in the prosecution system. And there's a lot
absolutely,
of them.
Absolutely.
Exactly. And can you talk a little bit about that in that area? How do you feel about that? And what are your thoughts
well,
on?
Well, you only have to look at, you know, in Norway, they don't even have, their prisons don't have bars, and they don't have cages. what they have are normal small rooms, but rooms just like at, you would live in a normal home. And the prisoners go out. They go out into society every day, go get work, find work, and then come back at night to their rooms. Somehow or other, Norway is able to do that. But when you treat people like animals, and you make it impossible them to find, real work when they get out, life sustaining work, where you can support your family, and where you when you go in for an interview, then of course then it has to come out you've been in, you've served time, so they're not interested in hiring you. They make it impossible. And then, of course, did you know that in this country there were 22 states that used to allow families to visit the prisoners even overnight? They were called conjugal visits. Sometimes it was just the wives or girlfriends. Sometimes it included the children.
I remember.
The world didn't come to an end because of that. But again, the drive now is to make the prisoners feel like, well, that they have a label, as you were saying, attached to them, criminal. That identifies them. That's who they are. That's who they will always be, and so on. And the fact is, if you treat people like human beings, they will act like human beings. The recidivism rate would go way down. A lot of the recidivism, what they call recidivism, is nothing but parole violations. And some of these parole officers are just looking for the chance to send the people back. So there's just a lot of injustices, connected with the criminal justice system. But what I am suggesting in terms of a movement is beginning to make links with other issues that of social justice, some of which are quite closely connected. For example, police brutality. And one of the things that has disturbed me is that those who advocate for prisoners' rights hardly ever talk about police brutality, and those who out there in the streets who have been by the millions who've been protesting police brutality never raise the question of the conditions and of prisoners and the incarcerated. And of course it's closely linked, they're both connected to the criminal justice system. So I'm suggesting that what we need is a movement that understands that we are the victims of a society which is entirely, completely unjust and is being run just in the interests of a few, and they get fewer and fewer every year. The wealth is just being shoved in, they're shoving the wealth into their hands, and making it impossible for people, to survive. The fact is, if say a person commits a crime, that doesn't mean that, for example, even murder, that doesn't make them a murderer, period, a murderer all their lives. They were, sometimes it was a crime of passion for the moment. They will never do it again. Sometimes if something went wrong that wasn't planned, even that, in that case, and you know that in Europe, for example, in many other countries, there is no sentence longer than 20 years.
Exactly.
There's no such thing as a sentence without parole and all that. So, but of course it suits the powers that be. And it suits the powers that be to label these people that they throw in prison by the millions and millions, and divert people's attention and saying the reason you're suffering, the reason you're having a hard time is because of those people behind bars. We got to keep them there. Instead of pointing to the people who are really exploiting them, really cheating them, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. Miriam Jacobs from the Netherlands, she's a psychosocial therapist. She speaks on the Netherlands as well, and Franz Kurz from Germany. They speak on the same thing you mentioned about Norway. So the United States, and we have a caller I'm going to get to in a minute, but in the United States of America, we are the only country, as you say, that has this kind of harsh, barbaric, not only sentencing, but treatment as well. And I think it's very, very unfair. But I'm going to bring on the caller here. I'm just taking him off mute or her off mute. 6606, you want to state your name, please?
Yeah, this is Joe.
Okay, we have another Joe. Joe K., this is Joe. He
yes, Leona, if you could do me a favor. Number one, I have a hard time. I'm having a little hard time hearing. So if you could repeat if the whatever the caller has to say or ask.
Oh, okay. So, Joe, do you have something you want to say to the audience and to Joe?
Yeah. Of course, the problem is it's something that you've been involved in for a long time. And I, as a lay person, I actually understand the ramifications. If people who are incarcerated, especially those who are innocent, when they get out, if they're not given a chance to actually rehabilitate or fit back into society well, make a living, et cetera, that the chances of their going back to prison is probably pretty good. Now, what I'd like to know is what are the practical solutions that have gotten actual results in keeping people out of prison before they get in, and if they are in, what's being done to have gotten results to keep them out once they've gotten out?
Okay, I actually heard that all that, Leona. So okay. you don't have to repeat it, but I have a hard time dealing with the framework that pinpoints the criminals as the ones who wind up behind bars instead of the ones walking around free as a lark and who hold political office. Most of them are corrupt. Most of them take bribes, et cetera, et cetera. And we keep talking about how do we rehabilitate the people behind the bars when, as I say, the people who are the fat cats, the rich people, the corporations, commit infinitely worse crimes. Do we ask those people do we offer them programs for rehabilitation? We never even acknowledge that they are the worst criminals of all. So
no, we do. We have investigative reporters. We have whistleblowers. A lot of people are very well aware.
And the reporters, look, the reporters work for newspapers or television stations, and they are under orders as to what they can report and what they can't report. And you have all of these are commercial enterprises. If they want to have commercials on their station, they better not. Expose the fat cats. Otherwise, they'll lose all their commercials, and therefore they will lose their financial.
You're right about that. But there's also books written by, this escaped my name, and it's Peter Schweitzer. There are a lot of people that I've talked to, and we're all aware of particular dangers and the corruption. I've had shows on corruption that emanates from the White House, from Congress, from the governors, et cetera. But my question was about the people
addressing what you were asking before, but I wanted to make sure that we understood that the real criminals never serve a day behind bars, and nobody talks about their criminality or their rehabilitation. But let's talk about the people who do go to prison. What jobs are offered to them when they get what skills, what training do they get in prison so that they can come out with a trade of some kind, and will they be discriminated against even if they get those if they have the skills?
Yes, you're right.
That's why I
asked the question the way that I did.
Right.
Can I intervene on this one? Because I know someone personally that's been going through this for some time. This is an individual who's been in 26 years, a first-time offender, a victim before becoming an offender, and he has been trying to take higher educational correspondence courses. He has been trying to get work programs in the prison. They have denied him every opportunity because they don't want him to be having anything to show for his time in prison. He cannot go up for parole because he has nothing to show. He's tried to file lawsuits. And what they did about 5 or 6 years ago, in the middle of the lawsuit, they put him in the hole. And they filed a motion to have the lawsuit dismissed. And once it was dismissed, they let him out of the hole. When he learned of this, he tried to get it back to do the appeal with the courts when the coronavirus started. So what they did in turn, they took and put him on a restrictive block. He's been on for going on 3 years now with no TV. They gave away his law books. He's been struggling to keep his sanity. And this is how they do with some of these people. Being an advocate for prisoners for the last 25 years, doing international work at one time with New Vision Organization, and now I just focus on Massachusetts. But I have seen and heard and witnessed, and this has been an ongoing issue. This person had a job. He got a job in culinary. He was on the job for 2 or 3 weeks, and he and his instructor were getting along fine until two officials went to the instructor to have him fired. When the instructor wouldn't get rid of him, they ended up going over the instructor's head to have him fired. Some of these prisoners, they get targeted, and they get deprived, they get abused, they get everything. And I get so sick of it, because even politicians have called over to the prisons to find out why these things are happening, and they're getting lied to. The unfortunate thing is they don't pursue it. They don't challenge the Department of Corrections. So that's where we have criminals that should be behind bars that are still out there getting away with it, because they either are in uniform, they have titles, or people just like them because they feel like the media, they can get benefits by only reporting the one side, and that's the side with people of titles, wealth, and uniforms. And these reporters are all getting, they're all getting benefits.
Yeah, Leona, the case you cited, there are thousands of them like that.
Exactly.
So that's why I say we have got to unite. You know, I notice there's so many.
I know that. I want to ask this question one more time, fellas. Okay, just one more time.
Sure.
I understand about the movement that you want to start, and I understand Leona's passion. Everybody's talking about the problems. Yes, they exist. They're atrocious. My question was, and I'll repeat it, is that have there been any practical mechanisms put in place to get actual results?
Okay? That's where the movement comes in. That's what I'm talking about. That's where
I'm not asking about in the future. I'm asking, listen to my question, fellas. Has
I know it's definitely been. I'm going to say something. When I was a social worker years ago, Cape and Islands Department of Social Services, they came out with this thing where anyone who has a child that's 5 years of age or older, they had to go to work. They provided the daycare. They provided the funds for the daycare. But they see, this is what happens with our government. They think half-assedly, because what they did, they were going to provide for the daycare. They didn't put into place that the person may not have a driver's license or a way to get around. And if you live on Cape Cod, everybody knows it's very difficult to get around unless you have a driver's license and an automobile. So here they wanted the person to go to work, but the person may not have had a driver's license or a vehicle to get to work. Other mothers were having problems because the daycare was opening after they had to be at work. So there was all these other issues that weren't even thought of when they came out with the solution.
That's true. Let me try to finish.
Okay, let me try to finish up my question.
I want to ask this one more time.
I want to answer your question. I want to answer your question.
Do you mind
what you are essentially asking is,
Joe,
is there a quick
fix? Can I finish the question?
The question you're asking is there a quick fix? Is there a solution now that somebody can come to? Never mind what's going on in the future. What about right now? That's your question. And the answer is, if there were a quick fix, you wouldn't need a movement. If there were a quick fix, we wouldn't need a movement.
I'm not asking.
The fact,
listen to what I have said. Do not, please, do not interrupt.
Sure,
let me finish.
Sure.
Okay? I'm asking, has there been any mechanism, anything at all that has gotten results? I'm not asking for quick fixes. That's not the terminology I use. That's not what I'm trying to imply. I'm asking, has there been anybody, anything, any organization, any entity that has gotten results? Innocence Project has gotten results of getting people out of, innocent people out of jail.
Okay. Yes, yes.
I'm asking
There is a place called the Innocence Project.
Excuse me
there's
for
a,
talking.
There's an organization. There's an organization called the Innocence Project, and what they do is they have brought out hundreds of people who were guilty. That's called the Innocence Project, and if you Google them, you'll be able to find them and so on. I take the position that there are hundreds of thousands of
around questions of people I don't listen to. Okay,
I don't care what your movement is
if you don't answer a simple question. Okay.
The problem is you're not satisfied with my answer. But I would like to go on.
You keep interrupting. Excuse me for talking while you're interrupting.
Excuse me, but I was invited to speak as a guest of the program, and you are filibustering right now. You know that? You're not allowing me to speak.
As a guest of the program, you should know that if a person is there to ask a question, you should answer it.
But you asked it about three or four times, and you're not satisfied with my answer. I'm sorry about that. But my point
is, Leona, do you think
you could do anything about it?
All right, never mind.
Okay,
let me
start this right now because I want to, first of all, Joe.
I wanted to address this question about who are the innocent people, you know, and the fact that they get several hundred people.
This
is an important question, whether you asked it or not. And I say there are hundreds of thousands of people in prison who are innocent in the sense that they were given sentences that were much harsher than they should have gotten, number one. Number two, that once in prison, they are so abused that they don't deserve the kind of treatment they get, and therefore they are innocent of the crime for which they are being punished so brutally. So what we need is a movement. There is no short-term solution like tomorrow we can solve it. We can't solve it tomorrow. We have to get people together who are only right now concerned about their own loved ones or their own situation and realize that we need a movement involving hundreds of thousands, even millions of people to come together to see the common thread behind all of their problems, the people who are suffering from the prison conditions, the people who were railroaded into prison, the people who are victims of police brutality, the people who are being cheated by not even being given a living wage. All of these people need to come together into one movement that then you will get real results, but just scattered individuals looking for NGOs or agencies or this bureau or that bureau. As I said in my introduction, you can get, once in a while, somebody will get a measure of justice, but in terms of the thousands and thousands of people who are suffering injustice, it ain't going to happen.
I think what happens is, and he got off the show.
Yeah,
but I think what he was looking for is other than the Innocence Project, other organizations that could actually say that there was some success stories or there was some people that came out of prison that they helped and it worked. But what I was going to say is in this country, when I travel these 11 third world countries, one thing I found in all of these countries is that everybody is laid back. No one is stressed out the way we are in this country because everything is on a time thing. Now, we have a whole hour, and all of these things can be addressed in that hour. It doesn't need to be addressed right away. It doesn't need to mean that two or three people have to be talking at the same time. But I believe what Joe was asking was if there was any other organizations out there that have done any good, that have seen any success. And I personally can say one thing. A lot of these organizations, especially these nonprofits, when they start out, they might start out for the good, but when they see money coming in, their whole thing changes. I have a problem with ACLU. ACLU, they have so much on their website, but they advertise so much for civil rights violations. They do this, this, and this. They don't do anything when you call them. There have been people that I know that have died unnecessarily because ACLU did not respond. They did not want to do anything. And that's the same way with other organizations. Even in the state of Massachusetts, there are civil rights law firms, there are lawyers, there are legal services, prison and legal services, all of these that talk so much and do nothing. What they do is they get the people to help that they know are going to benefit them. Those people that they're helping either have connections themselves or they're wrongfully convicted. When they come out, they're all over them. They're talking all like they've been best friends all their lives. There was a lawyer that represented an individual in Massachusetts, and the individual went to prison. He went to prison for life. And it was another lawyer, Rosemary Scapaccio, who ended up getting him exonerated. But the lawyer that represented him, that ended up not being able to represent him good enough because he was of color, and this lawyer is white, Jewish. So what he did, he had his arms around this young man in the media because he wants to look like the big shot that did all the good work. He wasn't the one that did all the good work, and he is the same one that ripped a woman off of $4,500 to go and see her son one time with a young Hispanic lawyer. He used this people of color to get to people of color. And this is what I can honestly say from experience. I can name lawyers to rip people off, but I'm not going to do it in this conversation. I'm going to do it, though. I have other people that are doing the same thing, gathering the information. So at one point in time, we're going to expose a lot of them.
Yeah. Well, I think what you said is so true. And the thing about defense attorneys, they have about 5 minutes. That's the time they have to deal with the defendant in court. So it's a sham. The idea is for the defendant to take a plea, period. And 98% of all prisoners, all defendants wind up taking a plea. The idea is to make it look like there's justice when there is none. And these organizations that you're talking about, these NGOs, are not for profit and so on, who get money from the big foundations, who in turn get money from the wealthy and the corporations again, you know, are there to make it look like something is happening that isn't happening, to make it look like there's justice being done when there isn't. So the answer is that there is no shortcut. There is no magic bullet. We have to roll up our sleeves and bring people together, bring family members from who have all kinds of different concerns, and have them understand that they're all linked together in one struggle for justice, and that includes people on the outside who are struggling against police brutality or one of a thousand other issues. It's all about the nature of our society, you know. As we said from the beginning, why is it this country, with only 5% of the world's population, has 25% of the world's prisoners? Are our people so much more criminal than any other people in the world? It doesn't make sense. So we have to step back and look at what the heck is going on, and not take it for granted, not take it for granted that because you're locked away, oh, you must have done something wrong. Or if you were sentenced to 5 years, well, you deserve the 5 years, and so on and so forth. So this is basically the point. And the way they keep things going like this is they divide people. Number one, they divide them up racially. They divide white from black and black from brown and so on and so forth. And you keep people fighting each other instead of fighting their real enemy. That's been our problem. So I applaud you, Leona, because you have been persistent and you understand the dynamics of what's going on in this society. You understand the injustices, and you've been trying to bring people together. And I wish you all the luck in the world. And, you know, in my small way, if I can assist, I would be happy to.
Well, you know, Joe, like I said, it's frustrating because this. I used to love this country. I loved everything about it. I loved working for the government myself until they took a young man who had never been involved with the law before, who was never involved to this day with substances of any sort, won't even take a painkiller for pain, was in his he grew without a father, without any siblings. He struggled throughout school, started working at the age of 13. He worked through high school, went to prep school up in North Bridgeton, Maine, Academy, and he went from there to 4 years of college. In his last year of college, and he was vulnerable. They didn't check. What happens in this society is when there's a crime, they don't look at both sides. They don't dig deep into what caused the person to stumble, what caused that person to go into severe depression, or what caused them to do this or her, whatever the case may be. They don't. They just look at the person who committed the crime, and then it all focuses on that person, especially when it's a black-white issue, and especially when it's a male against a female. People have to realize that males can be abused by females just as easily as females can be abused by males. But they don't look. We live in a society in this country that is so divided, as you say. They even use, they will use their own people. They will use the people. They will use blacks against blacks, beige against beige, red against red, brown against brown to separate them. They will try to prevent some of them to make the others feel like they're not racist. They're my friends. This is how it's divided. And people should know.
And in prison, the warden and the officials, you know, keep people divided also, and include and incite division, you know, incite one group against the other.
Exactly.
So that they can control. They think they can control the prison better that way. But they do it out in society. What I say that, you know, the greater society is just the prisons is just a microcosm of the greater society out there outside the walls.
And I don't think female guards should be in a male prison, and I don't think male guards should be in a female prison, because this Lowell prison in Florida, female prison, where all these women were getting raped by the prison, the penal system employees, the staff. And this is what really upsets me, because I don't believe males should be in a female prison. I don't believe females should be in a male prison. I trained with the Department of Corrections in 2006, mental health management, for 2 or 3 weeks. I didn't stay, but I was there enough to even listen to the females, the way they talk. They're like men. They have vulgar languages and everything else. And they don't want you to talk to the prisoners. But my supervisor, when I mentioned it to her, she told me, she said, Leona, she said, don't listen to her. She said, I talk to the prisoners. This is how we help them. We help them by communicating, interacting with them. But see, there's people in the prisons that are in the prison to punish, as you say in your book, the crime of impunity, the crime of punishment. These people in the prison, a lot of them are in there to punish more, beyond punishment. And that's anybody that has that mentality had to have been raised by parents that had no heart, no care in the world for another human being either. And unfortunately, this is what we have to face in this country. And another thing, they put gang members and other prisoners all together, clustering them like cattle. Instead of putting people in prison according to the crimes they committed, Put the first-time offenders in one prison. Put the repeat offenders in another. Put the serial killers in another. Put the gang members in another. But no, they want to, like you say, incite violence by mixing them all together.
Yep, that's right, Leanna. Well, as I say, we need a movement. We need a movement. We need the prisoners themselves to start organizing like they did back in the 70s, 60s and 70s. The prisoners were much more politically conscious then, and they organized and they were connected to the people outside, and they were able to get the media, force the media to confront their conditions. And even today we have prisoners' movements around the country where people go on hunger strikes and so on, and of course are brutalized for that. But we need to connect up with that. The people on the outside need to, and especially family members and friends, need to connect up with the movements inside. And the people inside need to know that there are people outside who are, working to change conditions. But at any rate, it's a long road, and there's no magic bullet. People just have to be ready to take it, and state by state, begin to. I noticed a dozen groups. You remember you sent me the websites and the groupings of about a dozen groups connected to the issue of prisoners, and. The thing is, they all ought to be united. It doesn't matter what the particular grievance is. It's all related to the same one grievance, which is that people in prison are not being treated like human beings. I watched on the TV the show about zoo. I don't know if you ever see these zoo shows on TV. Well, they show how lovingly the animals are treated and how they're made to feel at home. Mm-hmm. In their natural habitat, and they create exactly the same kind of natural habitat as they had when they were not in a zoo. And while that's going on, they are treating human beings, worse than animals, and making, the housing become, the housing conditions there become increasingly brutal and crowded. We see what's going on in Rikers Island. Practically every month there's somebody else dies, a young person dies in the jail there. And they haven't even been convicted of a crime yet. So it's all related, it's all linked together. And
there was a recent attempt right here in Norfolk this past month. Somebody attempted suicide. I understand from the individuals at the incarcerated at Norfolk, he's going to be okay. And they said they're going to try to give him as much support as they can. They're going to do it. The prisoners are going to support the prisoners. When these people are attempting suicide, and many of them have succeeded, you would think that the legislative members or somebody out there would step in and stop making, ongoing visits. I always say if the legislative members made a visit to the prison every 3 or 4 months, it just to meet with the prisoners to find out what's going on, the Department of Corrections officials, commissioner or whomever, would know that they are being monitored. So there wouldn't be, when they know they're coming, they clean up their acts. But if they were
and
making...
Why are prisons, hundreds of miles away from where most of the people live? So that it takes hours to commute back and forth.
Exactly.
We could go on forever and about these abuses. So then when you see so many different abuses, you have to realize this is not accidental. It's deliberate.
Yeah. There's a woman, and I'm going to tell you, this is one of the things I admire about some of these politicians. This is the difference between cold-hearted and warm-hearted. She is running for senator. Her name is She's a state representative, Liz Miranda. Liz Miranda's brother was killed. And yet this woman is fighting to abolish life and life without parole sentencing. She is for prison reform. Now, this is somebody who has been an advocate and a politician for years. She's a politician. But yet we have people who claim to be caring of animals and caring of so many different things, and what are they doing? But they're out there just like they did with Jesus, you know, do away with them, do away with them.
Yep.
But people like Liz Miranda, even and I would say Sonia Chang Diaz was running for governor, and she stepped down, but she's still on the ballot if anybody wants to vote for her.
Yeah.
Of course, I
don't trust anybody in those political parties. I think we need our own party. That's what I think.
I'll tell you,
where they don't funnel a whole lot of money into it, you know, and lobbyists and all those kind of things that keep the politicians well funded and all that.
And I will say Matthew Fogg, he was a former U.S. Marshal for the United States, and he and some
mm-hmm.
others filed some major lawsuits against the government because of racial discrimination with them. Matthew
mm-hmm.
Fogg is running for Congress. He's out of Maryland. He's running for Congress. And if anybody wants to get in touch with him, he'd be perfect. He's not a politician. He's a person that's fed up with the way the system has been running. And he is running to be on the Congress. And we need some people on Congress who are not biased, except
mm-hmm.
biased in the form of injustices.
Yeah. Well,
so Joe, I wanted to ask you, whatever brought you into this field that you've been in all these years, that you and your wife were fighting for the criminal justice system?
Well, my wife was not so much into the criminal justice system as the social justice system, as I too. But I just came to realize, especially in the 70s and 80s, that crime was being used as a means of getting rid of, quote, troublemakers who were challenging the system. And that led me to also see that in a lot more, in most cases, people of color were getting a raw deal, and a lot of that was done to break up the civil rights movement, which they succeeded in doing. But then, when you do an injustice to one group of people, inevitably it spreads to other people. So while they started throwing hundreds and thousands of people, black and brown people, into prison, then they became harsher toward everybody, and so white people suffered as well. So that it's only possible, the only way we can resolve this is when people put aside these prejudices and this bigotry and understand that their fate is joined together, and they have to work together and fight together to get anything, if they're going to get anything accomplished. So, and it's true whether it's about, we're talking about prison, or we're talking about trade labor unions, or anything else out there, you know, even the social safety net. Why isn't in the South, for example, the social safety net is practically non-existent? There's no protections for people that exist in the North. In their welfare, various welfare provisions. It's because a lot of whites were sold on the idea that the social safety net only benefited black people. And so they wound up cutting off their nose to spite their face. So now nobody gets welfare payments or any assistance when they're unemployed and so on, or less than normal in the South, and that's all the legacy of racism, even though everybody now suffers from that.
I tell you, that's what makes the country so bad, is that because of the hatred and racism in this country, it's destroyed the country itself. It's destroyed a lot of people. It's divided a lot of people. It's made the United States of America look like a farce, like a joke to other countries. And
yeah,
now... I mean, it's terrible.
We're moving toward fascism, and that will mean that nobody will have any rights anymore. And the main appeal is racist appeal, and immigrants. And when they say immigrants, they mean immigrants of color. They don't mean the Ukrainians, for example, but they mean the Mexicans and Central Americans and so on. So all of this is going to, you know, come back to bite everybody if we don't, you know, change our attitudes.
It was on
At
the
any
news.
Rate, I see it's almost time to end on, the...
It was on the news yesterday or the day before. Of all these immigrants that were found dead in the truck, they were trying
Oh, God. That was horrible, horrible. Absolutely.
And, you know, if we only had the compassion, everybody wants to live like high and mighty. They all want to live in wealth. When people in poverty-stricken countries, they're content. You know, they don't have anything, and yet they have they have that comfort. They feel have that, I don't know, and the hospitality is just, unbelievable. They treat you so nice. And if we have something like that in this country, you know, I'm sure when God created the world, he didn't create it for everybody to have to cross borders or have permission to cross borders or things like that.
Well, the people come up here because the situation is so desperate in their own country, and the reason the situation is so desperate in their own country is because the United States has put in people to rule over them who are ruling it for the benefit of the United States instead of for the benefit of the peoples in their own countries. So that's another issue.
I'm going to be interviewing the beginning of August. I'm going to be interviewing, I'd like to have you connected with him too. His name is Brian Winters, and he's the founder of an American Union. And his whole philosophy is not to side with either politicians, either Democrats or Republicans, but to go for the fight for the policies, fight for the justice, fight for the, you know, the things that are supposed to be right. And with you and with him and Matthew Fogg, who is also against all this craziness, and he's not a politician, all of you getting together and maybe coming up with, you know, some kind of plan as well, I think that would be awesome. Because we truly
we'll see how it plays out. You know, stay in touch with me, and you know, I wish you the best. And again, you're on the side of the angels, Leona.
Well,
thank
Joe,
you very
not,
much. Thank you again for inviting me.
It's not so me, Joe. I want to make this clear, because when people say that, I feel first of all I'm embarrassed, and I don't feel that I deserve any of it. I am just a human being that was taught, I was raised to have some kind of compassion for people, whether it be people who committed a crime or not. When it comes down to being abused, when it comes down to being terribly abused or deprived, and when it happens to my own loved one, it makes me even madder. I don't expect to be around much longer. And what I'm going to do while I'm around is I'm going to expose as much as I can, and I'm going to do as much as I can, because I still have a loved one that may or may never get out, and I may or may never even put my arms around him again, but I will go down to my grave fighting for justice. And that's the way I look at it, because I am so upset with so many people who claim to be doing prisoner advocacy work and so many lawyers who are claiming to be fighting for those whose civil rights are violated when they pick and choose who they want to help. And when you have somebody that they go so far as to even the prison doctors go so far as into destroying the person, damaging them permanently, that is above and beyond the call of duty in their sick world. And what happens is these people become contracted with the Department of Corrections, whatever state they may be in. When they become contracted with them, they become employees of them, and they will do whatever the prison officials tell them to do. This has to stop. This really has to stop.
Well, God bless you, Leona, and you know, you can call on me again, maybe August, as you say, or some other time.
I'd like to know a little bit more about you and your wife and the late Miss Sarah Wright.
Well,
she started off, she wrote a book, The Child's Gonna...
But you know, it's almost it's only 3 or 4 minutes left.
You know, for some reason, I extended a little bit longer. If you can talk about Sarah's book, The Child's Gonna Live, a little bit about that.
Well, I can just say that Sarah grew up in a small village in South, in Maryland. in Jim Crow, Maryland at the time, where the KKK in her area of Maryland was very strong. And she came, her father was an oysterman, simple oysterman, and her mother worked in the fields, and they had a little land of their own, but they had to also work for others in order to survive. And she grew up poor, but she got a scholarship to help to go to Howard University, and there she literally starved for years, didn't have enough food to eat because they gave her $50, her mother gave her $50, and that was supposed to last for 4 years of college. At any rate, it's from the experience of suffering hunger and looking and seeing injustice that she became devoted to the cause of justice, to liberating her, to fighting against racial injustice, and then to fighting against injustice against all people, particularly in Africa, and in this country, the fate of African Americans. And when we heard the stories that she used to tell about her life, we said, "Gee, Sarah, you need to write this down." And so, even though she was just considered herself just a poet, she decided she would go ahead and write down these stories, and that became the novel. A great deal of suffering in the book, but I think there's a triumphant ending to it. She believed in the possibility of a different world, a world where we would all be treated as humans and all be treated with respect. And that's what she fought for and gave her life for, and spent years and years, even as a creator, using her art as a weapon in the fight for social justice.
Wow.
So if people wanted a tremendous emotional experience, a profound experience that you won't get on television or the movies or even most books, then I would recommend This Child's Gonna Live, Sarah E. Wright, Wright.
Wow. I'll tell you, you and your wife really did. And I noticed even now with your bio, you have a firm belief, not just for the people of color, but you mentioned that the white workers, the poor whites and the whites of modest means also have a stake in racial justice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And because you can't right. And what the game they played on the white worker was they made sure the black was the worst off in society. And then they told the white worker, "Hey, you may be poor, you may not have a pot to piss in, but look, you're higher up than those people in the bottom there, those black people." And so white people, a lot of white, poor whites, bought into it. And even though didn't have anything more than black people, they had their white skin. And that comforted them, and that kept them from uniting. They were mostly farmers. Instead of uniting with each other, they had the same conditions, the same exploiters. They were turned against, the white were turned against the blacks and said, "See, you're one of us." The rich white person said, "Yeah, we're all the same family." What was the family? The white skin, that's all. And as far as everything else, the white worker or farmer was just as bad off almost as the black. So I've written a few essays on this thing where I can go into it at greater length. And I show that wherever there's been progress for the white worker, it's only been through joining hands with the black worker.
I see that happening in the country. There was a time when it was, and I never experienced it, but I read about it and heard about it, when there was the racism was so bad. And then it seems like now there's a lot of interracial marriages. There's a lot of whites that are joined forces with the people of color, the blacks, the browns, the beige, and the red. There's a lot of unity, but yet there are those
among young, especially among young people. That's the nice comforting thing, then the hopeful thing, is that young white people do not suffer from that same kind of prejudice and bigotry as their elders. So that's the hope for the future, you know, and then their children as well.
Unfortunately, there's still some families out there that have that deep-rooted hatred for people of color and are raising their kids in that same way. Someone's got to break the cycle, and I hope that some people who have that kind of hate in them will end up, you know, getting rid of it and breaking the cycle so that we can start having normal citizens in the United States. Joe, can you let the audience know how they can get in contact with you or your books so that they can buy the books if they're interested? And also,
they can just order Amazon. Just order through Amazon and Amazon Books. And The Crime of Impunity, The Crime of Punishment. The crime of impunity is the fact that the rich fat cats who commit most of the crimes, the worst crimes, never spend a day in jail or in prison. The crime of punishment is that so many hundreds of thousands of people, millions, pass through the prison system and are brutalized, or get longer sentences than they should, in many cases shouldn't even go to prison in the first place. That's the crime. And the crime is committed by the people who are not supposed to be the criminals, but who are the real criminals. So, and my wife's book can be ordered through Feminist Press, Sarah E. Wright. I assure you, and that book, that is a monumental book. My book is just, you know, some facts, but her book is great literature.
Now, your book is very interesting, too, and it's not just facts. It was very interesting. I unfortunately loaned it to someone and haven't gotten it back yet. But I want to thank you, Joe, for coming on, and I want everyone to know what the reason I've enjoyed having Joe on the show, and this is my second time, and I hope he'll come back in the future, is because Joe has been doing this for years. And Joe, I don't know if you want to tell them your age, but if he's
I'm 91. 91.
91 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Joe.
I've been at, yeah. Well, the first 90 years are the hardest.
I'll tell you, do it that long, you have a lot of wisdom and you have a lot of knowledge and expertise in telling, and you really let people know what's been going on. But I hope
everybody has a contribution to make. Everybody has some information, some knowledge that nobody else has, because everybody's life is a little bit different. So when we put all our heads together and put our knowledge together, that's when we will get someplace.
And that's sad, because it's not happening enough in this country. You know, there's a problem, and yet they don't want to address it. We have another caller. If you have a few minutes, Joe.
Okay,
do you want to state your name, please?
Hello,
is this Chinupa?
This is Brave Bird.
Pardon?
This is Brave Bird.
Brave Bird?
Yes.
Okay,
do you want to ask
Joe a question, or do you have something to say?
Yeah, well, my Tahashi, my relative, Chinupa Gluhamani, gave me a connection to this line to talk about. I don't know what you guys are talking about now, but it gave me an opportunity to talk about on a radio to talk about our indigenous issues, the Lakota plight in our homeland.
Okay.
And I want to address.
Before you do, Joe, I want to let you know, Chinupa Gluhamani, he is the Sioux Indian from South Dakota. He has a show on every Friday. They have a show on every Friday and Saturday. the same call-in number, and he is pretty much 100% in agreement with what you talked about earlier today. He believes that it's necessary to all come together in order to
this country was built on the basis of the extermination and of the native peoples. It was built on the backs of indigenous and black people. So it's a strange democracy that we can say was built on the backs and the blood of black and red, call them red peoples or indigenous peoples.
And you know, I hope that I wish that maybe Chinua Buhamani could have you on their radio show too, because you have a lot in common in your thoughts and the things that have injustice that have occurred.
By the way, probably most black people have indigenous blood in them. They have some ancestry going back to some indigenous ancestry.
Well, let me correct you there. Let me correct you there. We do. In the Lakota Nation, when they tried to bring the minority to fight against the minority, okay, they called them the Buffalo Soldier.
Yeah, I know.
And when they brought them into our land in the Lakota Territory, we had a fort fully preserved to show that when they brought the African American to battle with the Lakota, the African American abandoned that fort completely, stripped themselves of their clothes and the guns, and ran into the streams and the canyons of our homeland to where we found them, and then eventually adopted them into our families because we had pity on them. They were trying to do, they knew nothing of. One thing that most people don't understand about when they came to my land, before 1900, the tallest European American U.S. citizen was what average height? The average height? The average height of him, the tallness of that person.
12 feet?
Tall was 5'6" on the average back and forth, and it was every one of them. But the average height of a Lakota woman before 1900, how tall?
Probably 5'7".
The average height of a Lakota man before 1900?
Probably 6 feet.
We are Buffalo people. The average height of a Lakota woman was 6 feet or higher. I got my pictures. I'll show
you.
It was my mom and dad's generation that we lost it when we got infected by European blood. Blue blood of the French, the Italian, the Spanish, and the English. My grandpa's generation, their height was 7 foot or taller. And these people were big people. They're Buffalo people, Buffalo hunters and gatherers, migrant, nomadic Buffalo hunters and gatherers. So when they came here, they used every technology they could to destroy us. Everything. I'd like to see nuclear bombs. But they did. They hit it, though. You know where it's at?
Yeah.
That radiation, that, you know where we're using it at?
Yeah.
On this telephone. The telephone is emanating radiation, geomagnetic electric radiation. If you hold this to your ear, you're going to end up getting that.
But they also
put it on your...
They also held atomic bomb tests over indigenous territory. And the people, many of the places are still suffering from that poisoning.
Yeah, it is. All of the uranium mine from southwestern part of North Dakota, all of western South Dakota, and the northwestern part of Nebraska.
Yeah.
All those waters are headwaters that go right into the homeland of the Lakota people, from the Ogallala all the way over to the Sechongo, up to the Hunkpapa. And the Cheyenne River.
Yeah.
These rivers that are the headwaters of these mining tailings fall into the water and it goes right through her. So they did. They're using the dugout uranium into the waters and the lands of our home. But
that's right.
Same time, they try to pay us with money. But you know that money, it come from our land and it come from our trees, and that dye comes from our flowers, our our berries, the flowers of our berries. So there's nothing that they can't pay us with that doesn't rightfully belong to us. And then
I was just going to say, we're going to be closing pretty soon. So what I'd like to have you do is whatever the message was that Chinupa wanted to get out to the audience to say that, and then any time we have left, you can finish.
Okay. Well, one of the things that I have a problem with is when, you know, one of my brothers, you know, Oyate Techa, Barney Peoples, and they kill him in the town here in Rapid City in Pennington County. You know, nobody gives a shit. They push him under the rug, oh, just another dead Indian. But an African-American got killed just next door over in Minneapolis, and the whole fucking world went on fire. So what's up with that?
Excuse me, but you know something? I enjoy having people come on the show, but I don't enjoy having that kind of language, not on this show. So take that to your home.
Okay, that's my passion. And unfortunately, I apologize for that, but, you know, right now I'm talking to these rednecks here in my state that don't seem to give a dang about, so I'm going to use a language that catches their attention right away. They won't pay attention until I sting them with that language. And then they say, you can't say, just like you did. You can't say, well, you know what? Address these issues that are happening to my people.
Yeah. Hello?
We never left our home, we never got in a boat, went overseas and then raped and molested your women and children and then kill your men and your elders and put my home on your cemetery and call it my home. F that. That isn't my home. I'm using your language because you guys don't understand my...
No, I understand. I understand because I'll tell you, the blacks, the browns, the beige, and the reds have gone...
My language. You've been on my land. You know what? 530 years later, I'm still not white.
I know.
I'm as red as
I'll
always be.
See, this is
and
how
whether you
this
like
is how
my language
damaged.
Or not, you have to understand you're on my land.
This
500
is how
years, 530 years, you still treat me like I'm less than a human being.
This is
how
much
okay, Leona, I'm going to hang up now.
Yeah, I am too because this
thank
is
you.
Not.
Good job.
Yeah, that's
we're
the
trying,
that,
we're trying
that's
to get a
problem.
We're
that's
trying
the
to
problem
get a
of this caller and the previous caller.
Right.
You don't
the thing
have.
You know, the thing is, it's mind-boggling because you're trying to focus and you're listening to all this talk and they don't seem to want to let you finish or try to.
That's right.
Act like we only have 5 minutes on a show when we have much, much more. But I thank you so much, Joe, for being on the show today.
Okay. Well, thank you, Leona, and stay in touch.
You too.
Take
and
care.
I really appreciate you. It's been an honor again. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
And I want to let the rest of you audience, I'm sorry to say, but this goes to show you how much frustration is in the hearts, minds, and souls of so many people of color. And also, not only the people of color, but as Joe mentioned, the poor whites, those who are down, those who are less fortunate. And we need to do something about this. It's a shame when people have to suffer so much because of hatred by people who should be thankful for the blessings they've received. Instead, they use those blessings in opposition to others. And there's a saying in the Bible, the last will be first, if anybody believes. And I can tell you, it's going to happen. The last will be first. So we can either work together in trying to make things better again, trying to listen to others instead of over-talking others, trying to appreciate what we have, no matter how big or small. Many of us have lost someone that we loved in some way, shape, or form, whether it be through death or whether it be through incarceration. Many of us have lost something or someone, and many of us have lost someone because of someone else that couldn't be honest enough to tell the truth. Someone that tried to destroy the minds of someone else. There was a young lady that talked to her boyfriend years ago into committing suicide, and he did. And she got a slap on the hand. She got a year. Had it backfired, and out of that severe depression, that young man did something to her instead. He would have been in prison serving a life sentence. There's a reason behind everything that happens in this world today. There's a reason that a lot of these people in prison do not belong in prison. And if they did do something serious, then they need to pay. But as Joe mentioned earlier, in every other country, the maximum is 20 to 25 years. We live in a country where we have mass incarceration, life and life without parole, suicides all over the country, severe abuses, deprivation, provocation, medical and psychological and spiritual damage. We have law enforcement that are out there doing crimes, killing innocent people and getting away with it. We have lawyers who can help a lot of these people. They file lawsuits. If they have 40, add another 20 if they have to. But include everybody that's being abused if it's in a prison. Don't pick and choose who you're going to be helping. The only ones that pick and choose are the ones that are either prejudiced, and I'm sure a lot of you are going to take in people of color to let everybody think that you're not prejudiced, or you're not going to do it because you want only those who can benefit you, that can make something good of you, that can publicize your thing. And ACLU, what are they doing? They wait until it's a massive thing. The whole country's in it. Like the immigrants. Okay, they're ready to jump in on that because they know there's going to be a lot of money coming in. But on their website, they don't say that. They say that they fight for civil rights violations, people that are being abused. I have a message for ACLU. Three people died in Pennsylvania in 2007 and 8 because you refused to help, knowing that they were suffering. People in Massachusetts have cried out to you for help. And the thing that bothers me the most is that a lot of these lawyers that deny helping a prisoner or prisoners will not even give you an answer as to why they won't help them. Either it's we don't have enough funds, we don't have enough manpower, or that's it. They just don't give you a reason. You know how frustrating that is when prisoners have tried almost every single law firm and lawyer in a state, the state of Massachusetts. And I'll tell you, Massachusetts is one of the racist states. This they said years ago. Massachusetts smiles in your face and they stab you in the back. That's what we're living in this state. And there are other states throughout the country like it. So when they talk about helping these individuals, they will help them if they know they got something coming to them, if they know that they can benefit off specific prisoners that they're working with. Other than that, if you don't have the funds, you don't have the help. And in some cases, if you have the funds, they will drain you on one or two visits and a lot of emails. They will drain you completely, so you can't afford to get a good lawyer. And there's a judge who knows exactly what's going on in the prison. She's no longer a judge. She's a professor, a law professor now, who will say, I'm so sorry. I know what's going on. I can't help you, but I hope you can get one of the others to help. Get one of the others to help. That's it. Everybody is good for passing the buck. Just like the school shooting with all those 19 kids, elementary school kids. After the damage was done and all these lives were lost, now they try to pass the buck. They try to blame the police, the school police inside. And he said he didn't know what he was supposed to do because he assumed that the law enforcement's on the outside, already ready to go in, stood out there like they were cowards. He assumed that they were going to take charge because they had been trained to go into situations like this. But everybody's passing the buck. Let's start looking at those people in politics and those people out of politics who are running for positions, for campaigns, for senators, for governors, for Congress, who are seriously, seriously wanting to make change, who are putting everything into it to get your votes. We don't need to go with those who are so popular with the majority. Because in the book of Exodus 23, it says, thou shalt not go with the multitude to do evil against somebody who is down. So for you, all of you that are independent and make your own decisions and are aware of all the injustices going on in the prisons and beyond, I give you credit. For the rest of you who are cowardly, too afraid to do what's right because you want to look good to your peers, your more well-to-do, your more corrupt, your more deceptive peers, go for it, because your day will come. Your day will surely come, whether it be before you leave this earth or whether it be after, because there is something beyond this system of things. If you go to the book of Ephesians, it'll tell you, we are not wrestling against flesh and blood. We are wrestling against powers and principalities, rulers of darkness in high places in this world. So if you're not going to be a part of the resolution, believe me, you are part of the problem. So we are going to end this episode now, and I hope that you all learned something from this today's show. Thank you.